Welcome to the podcast of the United Church of Bogotá. We are a Bible-based church ministering to the English-speaking community in Bogotá, Colombia. We invite you to join our diverse fellowship as we encounter God in worship and experience the impact of His grace on every part of our lives and in our world. To learn more, please visit our website at ucbogota.org.
We're going to look at the whole chapter this morning. Go ahead and keep your finger there because we'll be in and out of this chapter as we go through the sermon. This is actually our last Sunday in the Gospel according to Isaac. And if you remember last week's sermon, it kind of left a bad taste in our mouth because you see Isaac lying and you see some cowardice and you see him putting his wife in a vulnerable position and you think, oh, that's not really the way I want to remember you, Isaac, and I'm with you, but neither is this. This is not really a good look for Isaac and for the rest of the family, for that matter. The setting is Isaac thinks I'm about to die. And actually, he lives for 43 more years after this, so whoops. I'm about to die, and then that's how all these activities kick off. Usually, I'll tell you a story or something so that you can feel tension or you can identify with the characters in the story. This morning, I just want to set up a concept, an image for you, and it's this. Typically, we talk about how the Lord is our shepherd, right? And He leads me to green pastures and beside still waters, and He protects me and He keeps me and leads me eventually to safety, right? And in that image, we picture ourselves as sheep, right? Well, when I read Genesis chapter 27, I'm not picturing God shepherding sheep. I'm picturing him herd cats. So let me show you this video to get the image set up.
This man right here is my great-grandfather. He's the first cat herder in our family.
Herding cats. Don't let anybody tell you it's easy.
Anybody can herd cattle. Holding together 10,000 half-wild short hairs, well, that's another thing altogether.
Being a cat herder is probably about the toughest thing I think I've ever done.
I got this one this morning right here, and if you look at his face, it's just ripped to shreds, you know?
You see the movies, you hear the stories, I'm living a dream. Not everyone can do what we do.
I wouldn't do nothing else.
It ain't an easy job, but when you bring a herd into town and you ain't lost a one of them, ain't a feeling like it in the world.
EDS, managing the complexities of the digital economy.
That was actually a lot like it looked when I was trying to get my family to church this morning. So, you get the point, right? We, the family of God, this family of God, we're a mess. We really are a mess. And God's task is a lot like herding cats when He's dealing with us. And something that really surprised me in my studies this week is that Genesis chapter 27, as messy and ugly and embarrassing as it is, to the original audience, would have been a great source of encouragement and comfort. Why is that? It's because you realize that if God can herd these cats to the promised land, then He can get us there too. In other words, there is nothing that will stop God's plan of redemption, not defiance and not fraudulence, which sadly are the marks of the characters in this story. So let's start by talking about the defiance of Esau and Isaac. I'm going to read the first four verses, Genesis 27, starting in verse 1. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." "Here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man, and I don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your equipment, your quiver and bow, and go out to the open country and hunt some wild game for me. Prepare the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my blessing before I die." Now, you may be wondering already, if you're familiar with this story, how is it exactly that Isaac and Esau are called defiant? I mean, aren't they the victims in a story like this? Aren't they the victims of Rebecca and Jacob scheming up this blessing heist plan that they implement here? I've always thought that too. And then I learned this week that the original audience of this story wouldn't have been thinking like, "Oh, those pobrecitos, they're such victims, look at them." They would have been thinking, these guys are also villains. These guys are defying God. They were defiant to God's plan. They were defiant to God's ways. Let me explain. The first thing that would have been really alarming to an ancient reader is that when Isaac thinks that he is about to die, he only summons one of his boys. Wait a minute, I thought that when like an important person, the leader of a family, the head of a household dies, he was supposed to gather all of the males in his family to his deathbed and pronounce a public blessing on them so that everybody knows. There are no questions being asked. Everybody knows the succession plan. Everybody knows who's supposed to be leading the family forward and who's receiving the blessing of the father. So the fact that Isaac only calls Esau and not Jacob, these two are up to something, aren't they? It's something fishy. What is it? I'll tell you what it is. Do you remember when we started talking about the birth of Jacob and Esau, what God's plan was, who God had chosen to lead the family forward? It wasn't the oldest born, like our cultural instincts would tell us. It wasn't. It was Jacob. It was the younger. God says to Rebekah in Genesis 25, 23, before the boys are born, two nations are in your womb, and two people from within you will be separated. One will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. And you know what? Isaac does not like that. Isaac doesn't like the fact that his oldest boy, Esau, is not going to get the blessing, the birthright, and carry the family forward. So he brings Esau in to give him a private blessing. You can tell that he's upset about the order of things because actually down in verse 29, which we'll get to in a bit, he says, "Be Lord over your brothers and may the sons of your mother bow down to you." He thinks he's blessing Esau, but he's actually blessing Isaac. But he's saying, you know, the sons of your mother, like your mother's favorite son and all of her or and all of his children, may they serve you, Esau, my boy, my firstborn, my blessed one, the leader of the family. And one of the things commentators say is that Isaac is not just using like harmless religious language, like, "Oh, Esau, bless your heart, you know, you sweet firstborn you." But that actually what he's doing is pretty twisted. Because he is attempting to thwart God's plan, and the weapon he's using is God's powerful blessing. He's using God's powerful blessing to twist God's plan in his own direction. You see how messed up that is? And oh, by the way, have you forgotten why Isaac wants so badly to bless Esau. It's not just because he's like a traditional guy and wants to do things the old-fashioned way and the firstborn gets this or that. No, it's because he and his wife are playing favorites. And Esau is his favorite boy of the two. And why is it that Esau is his favorite son exactly? Do you remember? Verse 3 and 4 says it again. Esau, get your bow. Go hunting. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like and bring it to me to eat. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like and bring it to me to eat. Before I die, can you just feed me one of those good meals one last time? You remember where Isaac's heart is, right? It's in his stomach. Isaac's appetite, this is what is so sad, Isaac's appetite is stronger than his theology. Not only does Isaac prefer a boy because that boy pays Isaac with food, okay, so you see how this is a transaction-based relationship? Not only is that happening, but Isaac worships his stomach so much, is enslaved to his own appetite so much that he is willing to defy God and God's plan. Isaac has been passive this whole time. Right here in his defiance to his God, he is not passive. He's active. And what about Esau? I mean, come on, Pastor. What does Esau do wrong? He goes hunting. You know, he brings some food home. He makes things like, oops, I got duped. You got me, guys. How is he part of the problem here? Well, first of all, the fact that he is going along with his dad's plan, indicates something about his own heart. It indicates that the vow he took a couple chapters ago, you know, to sell his birthright to his younger brother, that he's planning on breaking that vow, and he thinks that that's okay. That's not okay. The other reason that this is that he's a problem here is because he's in this position to begin with. He's sold his vow. And do you remember, he sold his birthright? And do you remember why he sold his birthright? Because he was hungry. Because he was hungry. And so now Esau is just like his dad, that he loves his food so much that it could outweigh his love for his God. He sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. Everybody knows he's not worthy to carry the promise forward, to lead the family after Isaac is gone. But it gets worse because Esau also defies God's ways. Very first sermon in this series, Abraham says what about his boy Isaac? Do not let my son Isaac marry one of these local pagan girls. Don't do it. Go all the way back to my family and find him a wife from my family. Don't let him marry someone who is not one of my people. Esau knows that. Do you know what he does just before this story kicks off? Verses 34 and 35 of chapter 26. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and also Basemath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. They were a great source of grief to Isaac and Rebekah. And now we see his other appetite. Not only is he a lover of food, but he is a lover of Canaanite women. Because he marries not one, but two Canaanite women. And any Israelite who is listening to this story for the first time knows Esau is not worthy to carry his family forward. Listen, people, God is herding cats, and we are only four verses into the story. This is a complete mess. But it's good for our hearts to just pause and linger here for a moment. to feel some of this tension, to ask ourselves this question: what is the matter with my own heart that I am so defiant toward my God? What's the matter with my own heart that I'm so quick to defy his plan, that I'm so quick to defy his ways? Could God ever herd a bunch of cats like us to the promised land? Or is he just going to throw his hands up in the air and say, you know what, enough is enough. I give up with these people. I mean, any other animal would be easier to herd than cats. It's actually right. Because I'm a geek, I read a lot about cats this week. And where cats come from, and you will know that I am not a cat person, and it's not just because my esophagus closes up whenever I'm in the same room as them, because I'm terribly, terribly allergic. It's not just because I have a dog, and I realized in the first service I have a dog treat in my pocket, so that shows you what's going on in my heart towards cats. This kind of weirds me out about cats. Cats are this uncomfortable reminder of humans at our worst. And I mean this, I don't want to insult you cat people, totally. But I want you to know that historically, humans did not make cats their pets. Cats made humans their owners. And that's serious. I'm not joking with you. They didn't come out of the woods because they loved us so, so much. They came out of the woods because being a human means you attract mice. And they thought, wow, this is really useful. These humans, these things, like, bring my food to the table. And so I'm going to be here, not because I like them, but because they're useful to me. A cat expert. And yes, if you're looking for a career, you can be a cat expert. Wrote this, that cats retain a large degree of independence and approach us, or stay close to us, only when they want to. Uh-oh, this is starting to sound familiar. They do what they want and when they want, and the owner is only there to serve their interests, freed of emotional attachment or relationship from the cat. Do you see it? Do you feel this? How do we treat God often? Well, his plan and, you know, his way and, like, intimate relationship with him, but only when it's convenient for me. Only when it's good for me and it fattens my belly. We're herding cats. Let's keep going, because there are more than four verses in this story, right? I want you to shift suddenly to the scene of a telenovela, right? And as Isaac and Esau are scheming to cut Jacob out of the will, you see the camera, and it kind of pans around, and there's somebody behind the corner who's listening in, and it's Rebecca. And listen to the plan that Rebecca comes up with, starting in verse 5. Now Rebecca was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebecca said to her son Jacob, "Look, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat, so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of the Lord before I die.' Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me 2 choice young goats so I can prepare some tasty food for your father, just the way he likes it. Then take your father to eat so that he may give you his blessing before he dies." Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "But my brother Esau is a hairy man, while I have smooth skin. What if my father touches me? It would appear to be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing." His mother said to him, "My son, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. Go and get them for me." So he went and he got them and brought them to his mother, and she prepared some tasty food, just the way his father liked it. Then Rebekah took the best clothes of Esau, her older son, which she held in the house. She put them on her younger son, Jacob. She also covered his hands and the smooth part of his neck with goatskins. Then she handed to her son Jacob the tasty food and the bread she had made. Are you ever watching a film, reading a book, and just when you're really starting to like a character and want that character to succeed, they do something that is so corrupt that you're just kind of like, you know, turn the TV off, or you close the book and you put it away because you start to feel kind of slimy and dirty, because now all of the characters in this story are just corrupt, slimy, dirty people. That's kind of the way I felt about Rebekah this week, because just last week we were rejoicing with how courageous she was and getting behind her, and now this week she does just what her husband did to her. She dresses her son up like a fraud. And she's good at it too, you know. I mean, you heard me as I was reading that. You start to actually wonder if this is the first time she has been this fraudulent in the way she has dealt with her husband, or if she's picked up a lot from Isaac and his deception over the years. Look at how masterfully she does this. First of all, I don't know how to cook, but I imagine it's probably pretty difficult to make like a young goat taste like venison, and yet she pulls it off. Okay, impressive. Kudos. But then, you know, she gets really specific about the plan and has every detail covered. Jacob is like, well, I've got smooth skin, but not like in a good way, like a Nair commercial. I've got smooth skin, Mom. And you know, my brother, Esau, he's hairy like a goat, which is something. And so she has a plan for that. Don't worry, you know, we'll take some goat skin and we'll put it on the smooth part of your neck and on your hands so that if your dad touches you, then you feel like his son. Oh, and I'll get you your clothes. You know, I've got some Esau clothes. We'll put them on you, which is really awkward that she dresses her 40-year-old son. But she dresses her 40-year-old son. And now, not only does he feel like Esau, he smells like Esau, and the food, well, now he's tasting like Esau. And does he look like Esau? That doesn't matter, because after all, they are taking advantage of an old blind man. Jacob starts to feel a little nervous. Mom, what if I get caught? You know, then like I'll receive a curse. And she says, my son, verse 13, let the curse fall on me. Just do what I say. We should pause for a second there and allow the text to present us interesting ethical question number one, which is, as Christians, we are called to honor our parents, right? But what if they ask us to do something that is explicitly sinful? I see this happen a lot more with adult children than I do with adolescents and young people. But what should we do? I mean, hey, I want you to go and lie to your old, blind, dying dad. Should he do it? And the answer is no. No, we are called to honor our parents, but not when doing so is going to explicitly dishonor God. Besides, Jacob is not really honoring his mother if he goes through with this plan, is he? He's enabling her to dishonor God. And so no one is being honored, his mother or his God. But as you read on, the plan works. But again, it's kind of telenovela-like in its drama. I'm going to start in verse 18. He went to his father, and he said, "My father?" "Yes, my son," he answered. "Who is it?" Jacob said to his father, "I'm Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing." Isaac asked his son, "How did you find it so quickly, my son?" "The Lord your God gave me success," he replied. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him, and said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau. So he proceeded to bless him. "Are you really my son Esau?" he asked. "I am," he replied. Then he said, "My son, bring me some of your game to eat, so that I may give you my blessing." Jacob brought it to him, and he ate, and he brought some wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come here, my son, and kiss me." So he went to him and kissed him. When Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, he blessed them and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you heaven's dew and earth's richness and abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed." So the plan works. But did you see how much Jacob has to lie to make it work? Did you see the way he had to blaspheme the name of his God to make it work? "Wow, son, how did you get the game so fast?" "Well, the Lord your God helped me." That is so twisted. That is so wrong. You see what happens here. Jacob did a bad thing in order to get the right outcome. And so did his mom. You know, it's possible that her deceptive plan was more than just Rebecca playing favorites, that it actually comes from a place of wanting to honor God and respond in obedience to God's plan. What plan? Well, that Jacob was supposed to receive the blessing and not Esau. Now, if that is the case, her actions and Jacob's actions present us with interesting ethical question number two, which is, do the sinful means justify a holy end? If it means that God's plan will be accomplished, then should we sin in order to accomplish it? I mean, that's a relevant question for a lot of people. I hear you asking that question sometimes. Should I sin if it means that God will be glorified through it? Well, perhaps the rest of the story is going to give us the answer to our question, because again, in telenovela fashion, just as fraudulent Esau is exiting the scene, in comes real Esau. Whew, that was close. And unfortunately, there's nothing but heartbreak and anger from there. Verse 30. After Isaac finished blessing him, and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence, his brother Esau came in from hunting. He too prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. Then he said to him, "My father, please sit up and eat some of my game so that you will give me your blessing." His father Isaac asked him, "Who are you?" "I am your son," he answered, "your firstborn, Esau." Isaac trembled violently and said, Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came, and I blessed him, and indeed, he will be blessed. When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, my father." But he said, "Your brother came and deceitfully took your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? This is the second time he has taken advantage of me. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." Then he asked, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau, "I have made him lord over you and have made all his relatives his servants, and I have sustained him with grain and new wine. So what can I possibly do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father." Then Esau wept aloud. His father Isaac answered him, "Your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven above. You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke from your neck." Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." When Rebekah was told what her older son Esau had said, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is planning to avenge himself by killing you. Now then, my son, do what I say. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. When your brother is no longer angry with you and forgets what you did to him, I'll send word for you to come back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" So God's plan is accomplished, and Esau and Isaac are utterly devastated. Can you just feel the anguish in Esau's soul as he goes back time and time again? "Dad, my blessing, please, surely you have one more blessing for me." But instead of a blessing, all Esau gets is what theologians call an anti-blessing or the negative blessing. Why? Because that's all that's left. Verse 49 and 50 say, "You're not going to live in the promised land. And you're going to serve your brother, and your people will serve his people. At least until they get their revenge." And you notice in Esau's heart, he channels the fury of the original older brother, doesn't he? Of Cain. And he tells himself what? "I promise that as soon as my dad dies, I will kill my brother." Rebekah hears about this and brings Jacob and says, "Jacob, you've got to go to my brother Laban's house. Listen, I know that it's 400 or so miles away, but don't worry." In verse 44, it'll just be a little while. Actually, the Hebrew there says just a few days. Just be a few days. When it's safe, I'll call, I'll get you back. But I don't know if you know this. The day Jacob leaves to go and live with Laban is the last day Rebekah sees her precious son. And she lives for like another 20-something years. This is the last day she sees her special boy. And so back to our ethical question. Do holy ends justify sinful means? I bet if we ask Rebekah, "Hey, Rebekah, was it worth it? Would you do it again?" you'd hear something like, "Nope. No, it was not worth it. Blessing or not, I just want my boy. I just want my boy. I should have waited and allowed God to do what he wanted when he wanted." All right. All this talk about herding cats. Have you noticed who is surprisingly missing from the story? The shepherd. Where is the shepherd in all of this? I mean, where is God in all of this utterly sad family dysfunction? He's referred to here and there a little bit. But basically, this cat goes this way, and that cat goes this way, and these cats are fighting, and the shepherd is nowhere to be found. So how, God, if you're not in this story, are you going to herd these cats to the promised land? You may look at your own life this morning and think the same thing. I mean, just looking at the disorder and the dysfunction in your life, you may think, Lord, how in the world are you going to herd someone like me and my family to the promised land when I don't even see you in the story? Where are you, God? Where are you, God? All I see is sad and evil dysfunction. Where are you, God? People connected to the University of Javeriana this week, when the news broke, asking the same question. Where are you, God? And so where is he? You know, the reason you don't see him acting in this chapter is because God does not and cannot, by his nature, author evil. 1 John chapter 1, verse 5 says that God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. And since this chapter is basically just darkness layered upon darkness, layered upon darkness, then it shouldn't surprise us to see that God is not in it. But you know where he is? He's in the background. He's in the background of this story. You know what he's doing? He's making something really, really beautiful out of something that is really, really broken. And that, my friends, is the story of the whole Bible. It's God making beautiful things out of really broken things. And that, my friends, is your story too. It's God making really beautiful things out of really broken things. That explains the cross, doesn't it? I mean, the Jews kill Jesus for one reason, and the Romans for some other reasons. And Judas betrays Jesus for some money, and the disciples get scared, and they abandon Jesus, and we just look at that and say, frauds, defiance, what a herd of cats, what utterly broken, chaotic nonsense. And though it looks that way to us, it was actually salvation. I mean, Jesus, through all of that mess, all of that brokenness, was doing what? Beautifully paying for our sins. So that we can do what? So that we can act like Jacob. What? Act like Jacob. Here's what I mean. I'd never seen it until I read it this week. What does Jacob do in this story? Jacob dresses up like his older brother in order to receive blessing from his father. You and I are supposed to do the same thing in Christianity. We're supposed to go to God our Father dressed in someone else's clothing, dressed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ. This is what Isaiah 61:10 says. I delight greatly in the Lord. My soul rejoices in my God, for he has clothed me with garments of salvation and arrayed me in a robe of his righteousness. And there's Christianity. All who put their faith in Jesus, going to the Father for love and belonging and purpose, go, what? Covered in the righteousness of Jesus that he accomplished for us. And when we put our faith in him, he gives us freely in abundance, so that right now, if you are a follower of Jesus, you've repented and given your life to him, here is how God the Father sees you. You look like your older brother. You feel like your older brother. You taste like your older brother. You smell like your older brother. You sound like your older brother, Jesus, which means what? We stand in the family of God, worthy because of Christ, to receive the blessing that Jacob longed to receive from his father. This is my son. This is my daughter, with whom I am well pleased. Lord Jesus, we thank you for that.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you would like more information or would like to support the ministry of UCB, please visit our website at ucbogota.org.